Okay, so now I look like a politician or something. I've been meaning to start trying to record lectures with digital recorder just in general so that I could post them in case you missed the class or something was confusing, or I said something in such a way that it confused you just right and you want to go back and listen to it again to make sure that you're confused properly, then we'll, you know, hopefully have those. I have a several that I've tried recording with the thing just sitting up here, and I haven't actually taken the time to figure out how the quality is. But the lapel mics that I ordered one, and they sent two. I thought that was cool. Once I did that, I ordered a sheet of basically silver dollars, bullion, one point when I thought it was a good idea to try to diversify pre-kids, so I actually had a little bit of money that I was going to try to do this with. And I ordered, I don't know, 20 of these things, and they sent me two sheets. I'm still guilty about that. Don't tell anybody. I never sent it back. At any rate, so I don't know what it is. About once a decade, I get some weird thing like this. Okay, so one of the things that we have to do, which I actually would skip happily if I could, and I suspect some of you would too, we have to have our first exam. It'll be a week from Thursday. One of the bad side for many of you is that it'll be at 8 in the morning. And to make it worse, we'll have class that day too. So, because my reason for giving it 8 in the morning is so that we don't lose the class time. Now, I really have no problem if you sit in class looking brain dead. I get that a lot in a number of my classes, not usually in here. But if you had an exam that morning, feel free. The location is to be announced because I forgot to ask for a room until just a little while ago, so hopefully I will hear something. It's not a huge class, so hopefully it won't be a big problem, but I'll have to email you with that. It is a good idea to look at my old exams. I have posted them on the web. There is on the class website a link that will take you to a page where I actually try to just post all of my old exams. I believe that I still need to put up the 2008 Physics 142 exams. That is the most recent time I taught it, which I haven't put up because I didn't have to until right now. And so now basically I need to get it up, and we'll try to do that soon. Generally speaking, I will post one version which has no solutions on it, and then I'll post the solution set. So if you're rather than email me asking me to make out a practice exam, just do one of those, and that works. Usually, I need to give you a song and a dance about... You have to be a little bit careful. The coverage on the old exam might not have been exactly the coverage that's on this exam because it's all what point of the semester we decided to do it, which sometimes has to do with my travel schedule and things like that. I'm moving them around a little bit. So, but I think probably the 2008 exam one pretty much corresponds to what you're going to have. One of the things that's not good. Okay, one of the things that you can do is I'm not big on memorization, so because I have a colander brain myself, so it doesn't work well for me. You can take an index card, the regular 3x5 index card, and write anything you want on it front and back, just to sort of anything that's always you need your memory to be jogged. It's a bit of a stress reliever because I will also take all the basic formulas that we do and I will make a formula sheet and include that, okay? Generally speaking, if you're spending a whole lot of time trying to compactify the text onto this index card, you're wasting your time. I mean, that's not really what it's used for. But it's more of a put a few things on it, and you know, if you want to put an example problem or two, feel free. No topological enhancements. Laugh if you wish. I have had a class where I walked into the exam and somebody had taken, it was a later in the semester thing, and so they had a full 8.5x11 sheet of paper, but they had literally taped index cards to it. So they had increased its surface area by about tenfold. and thought this was okay. So, so no topological enhancements. Material coverage will cover basically through this week's stuff and workshop and problem sets. I may go further in lecture this week, and I'll have to look and see exactly where the material cuts off. But my intent is not to give you anything beyond what you've already had a problem set and a workshop on. So it will not be on next week's workshop stuff. The problem set and workshop, I will probably make Thursday's problem set due the following week. So you'll probably have like a double problem set due the following week. And I understand it's probably not a good idea to do it before Thursday's test, but then you don't want to just let it go and get really hammered the next week. So you'll want to probably start your problem set a little bit earlier, something like that. And you're welcome to work on it earlier. I'll try to post it in regular time, but I'll make the due date a little later. Okay, another thing which the responsibility is mine. You've been handing in your problem sets, and TA's been getting them and grading them dutifully, and the problem is that I need to go in Blackboard and insert a whole bunch of columns in a grading center for the TA to actually post the grades before the TA is ready to actually hand them back. And so that is really at the top of my priority list. I'll try to make that happen today, email the TA and say, okay, get this stuff in, and the problem sets will show up in the box, which I'll put outside my office door, and it will be in, there will be manila folders with sorted by first letter, last name, where you should be able to find them, okay? All right, so once things are in Blackboard, I mean, eventually I'll click it so that you can see them. If you look at them and there's an issue with any grade being wrong, what you need to do is just let me know, and we'll deal with it. Sometimes there's an issue whether you get a check mark or you don't get a check mark on your homework. I don't find that any TA I ever have in any class is all that consistent as to when they put check marks or not. So the best thing to do is to just look on Blackboard and see that you got credit for that. Any questions on any of this? Yes? I try to do that, yes. A little bit just depends on me having my act together to get the exam done on time. I could post last year's, and it's probably on the old exams when I get those on up. That will be my starting place. It is probably identical since this is more or less the same material. But I try to reserve judgment a little bit because if during the course of making out the test, I throw some nasty or semi-nasty integral at you that I feel you ought not to just sort of have at your fingertips, I will give you that form of an integral plus several others, so it's not obvious that that's the one you want, but it'll be on the formula sheet. And so I generally make out the exam and then take the exam, and it's during the taking of the exam I sort of make notes as to what I really need to make sure I have on the formula sheet. So I tend not to post the formula sheet till after the exam has been made out and I've taken it so that it's really ready to go, which, sometimes is not usually right before the test, but it's sometimes the day before.
And what kind of calculator
can we use? Good, thanks. Bring a calculator, bring a scientific calculator. You have the big 3x5 index card, so, if you really wanted to expend the energy to Xerox your whole textbook and somehow put it into your calculator, fine. Good luck. I wouldn't put any energy in that, so I don't care what kind of calculator you bring. I mean, a scientific one, that I would bring, because you will definitely possibly need to do sines and cosine thetas and things like that. But be careful because if you're solving a problem and you write down an answer because your calculator said that and you don't defend that really well, you don't get any credit. Right, because we will work hard to give you partial credit on everything, but we will only give you partial credit on things where we can tell what you were doing. And so it cuts both ways. If you are so brilliant you can look at a problem and you just know the answer and write it down, You're getting no credit. You have to show me. Except for sometimes I'll have problems where I'll explicitly say no partial credit or no need to show work or something. I give a mix of types of problems. I do this in part because it allows me to sort of hit more concepts. So there will be some multiple choice stuff. There will be some. There might even be like one paragraph essay-ish type problem. Certainly, especially in this class, real sets of analytical problems, that kind of thing. So you'll see a mix of things. And I do that for a few reasons, one of which is different types of problems are sort of in different people's comfort zones. Although in this class, it's a little bit more of a, well, you either like to do analytical problems or why are you at 142? Or, so there is a bit of that. Anything else? Okay. So last time we were talking about electric potential, and we looked at the potential for a point charge by just looking at how the energy changes as you move from one point to another near a point charge, and we find its form to be KQ over R. Then we can add these. It's a scalar, so this adds algebraically. If you have a system of discrete charges, then you can add up the discrete potentials. Q sub I gets added in with the algebraic sign of the charge itself. So you can have a whole bunch of charges here and actually have this sum to zero if those charges sum to zero, you know, scaled by the radii properly. If you have a continuous distribution, then as I hope you're getting really comfortable with for this class, the way to do that is to find a little differential piece of it, treat it as the point piece, that is the potential due to dq is k dq over r, and then do the integral over that whole volume in order to find the total potential. And okay, so that's the potential, and the reason that we care, in part at least, the potential does give you insight into the energy of the problem, but the other thing it does is it gives you an avenue to calculate the electric field. So the electric field is the slope of the potential. The component of the electric field in a given direction, E sub s, is the negative of the slope of the potential in that direction. So in three dimensions, we say that the electric field is the negative of the gradient of the potential, which is this combination of partial derivatives, which is really nicely written in terms of this vector operator del. And then I think toward the end of class we talked a bit about equipotential lines. So basically realizing that the electric field is the gradient of the potential, then it means that you will have equivalent potential if you go at right angles to that slope or to that gradient. And so if you were to draw the electric field lines and then draw lines that were perpendicular to them everywhere, you would find those lines that are perpendicular are always at the same potential, and we call them potential lines. Okay? So, what I'd like to start with today is to look at the electric field of an infinite sheet of charge. And I hope that that bothers you a little bit, because there is no such thing as an infinite sheet of charge, but we're going to play pretend, which you're going to learn to do a lot of in physics, and we're going to sort of think that there is an infinite plane of charge. And infinite sheet with a uniform charge density. Which we'll define as sigma. And of course, sigma is charge per unit area, so it has units of coulombs per meter squared, or actually C per meter squared. And so the question is, what is the electric field as a function of sigma? So this is a planar problem, so we want to, it also has a lot of symmetry in it. So what I'd like to do is to use Gauss's law to solve this. So imagine that if we look from the side of this infinite plane of charge at a segment of it. What I'd like to do is to consider if we had a cylinder with flat end caps and we bisect the pipe piece by the plane. So we do something like this. And if we look at it from the other direction, so I've taken an elongated pillbox or a segment of a pipe, and if this is the plane, I have taken it and put it like that. Okay, so we have the end caps that are parallel to the plane. Alright, so if we do Gauss's law on this, I mean, by the symmetry of the problem, the electric field has to be headed straight out like this in both directions. So if we look at Gauss's law, integral of E dot dA is equal to Q enclosed over epsilon naught. It's the integral of E dot dA over the entire Gaussian surface, which we're considering. The electric field is going this direction. On the pipe surface, the dA will always be out at right angles to the electric field, so E dot dA will always be zero. So the electric field, this term is always zero for the pipe piece. The only stuff that is non-zero is that on the end caps you have dA pointing outward and you have the electric field pointing outward. So E dot dA is not zero there. In fact, if we bisect the pipe with the plane properly, then by symmetry we know that the electric field at each end cap has to be the same and it has to be constant across the whole end cap. So the integral of E dot dA becomes the integral of E times dA, and E can pull out. So it's just the integral of dA over the two end caps. In both cases we have dA pointing out that way, but E dot dA is positive in both cases because the electric field is also pointing out. So what we end up with on the left-hand side is 2 times the magnitude of the electric field times the area of the end cap, which I will have forgotten to say. So we're going to say that the end caps have area A. So 2 times E times A is the left-hand side, and the right-hand side is going to be sigma times A over epsilon naught. Sigma times A would be the total charge enclosed inside the pipe, because if the pipe has a uniform cross-section, the end cap area here, A, is the same as this circle that is etched out on the plane. So the electric field the A's cancel, it's just sigma over 2 times epsilon naught. And this is one that you're just going to be having to use all the time. So this is then the magnitude of the electric field to one side of the plane, and it is the same as the magnitude of the electric field to the other side of the plane, but they are going in opposite directions. Okay? Now, note that this electric field strength is the same as it right here as it is 200 yards over that way. Right? It does not fall off in strength. It's uniform to each side of this. And, I mean, I hope that bothers you a little bit. It does me. But It's sort of part of the game. We have this infinite sheet of charge, so things are a little bit strange that way. Okay? If the sheet were not infinite, clearly you're going to have something else come in, because you can go far enough away that that sheet looks like a point. So it's going to have the field of a point charge out there. Okay? So there other things come in. But if it's infinite, you have this constant electric field. Similarly, if we have the same problem and we have that sigma is negative, then E goes this way. And there's really nothing to change the problem. So you will have E going inward, and the magnitude of E is going to be equal to sigma over 2 epsilon naught in the same way. Okay? Now what I'd like to do is to look at a situation where we have each of these things. So just a reminder, we have this with positive charge. Which gives us an electric field that is going out like this. And to the other side, and then what I would like to do is a short distance away. Oops, wrong thing. Actually, this wasn't worth the trouble. Sometimes you win, sometimes you don't. What I'd like to do is to have negative charges on this one, have the field pointing this way. And imagine what happens if we put these things in close proximity to one another. So if I take this, the charge densities are the same. What happens? They get a black and pink mess.
Yeah.
Can you tell what's going on here? Yeah. So the fields superimpose, right, everywhere. So everywhere to the left of this pink one, you have an electric field going to the right. Everywhere to the left of the black one, you have an electric field of the same magnitude going to the left, and those two vectorially cancel. So the electric field will be zero out here, everywhere. Similarly, you have the same situation over here. In the middle, however, they're both going the same direction. So what you end up with when you put these two parallel plates of charge with the same charge on each but opposite sign together is you'll end up with a situation where you have E equals zero out here, E equals zero out here. This plate is positive, this plate is negative, and you'll have an electric field that is uniform in here, straight across, and the electric field in strength will be twice what it is for either one of the sheets. And so the sheets were sigma over 2 epsilon naught, so the electric field strength here will be sigma over epsilon naught. Okay? And this is what we call a parallel plate situation, or as we'll find, often it's called a parallel plate capacitor. But it's a magic way of creating a uniform, easily knowable electric field. All right, so you'll just see it again and again and again because of its there's a nice utility to that. So we'll use it as a starting place for studying lots of things. You okay with that? All right, so often this is called a parallel plate capacitor. If you haven't figured it out, when I say the word parallel, I write something like this, and perpendicular is at right angles. So it's a parallel plate capacitor. All right, so let's imagine that we have a little electron, and it gets placed right here near the negative, or right on the surface of the negative sheet. Because it's in an electric field, it's going to drift this way. It's going to move toward the positive sheet. So one question that might come up is how much kinetic energy does that electron get going from one plate to another? So because we have the electric field and we know the distance, we can actually calculate that. That's going to be the amount of work done on the electron as it goes from one plate to another. So let me see how I want to do this. So if the electric field is minus dV over dS, then we know that the potential is the integral of E dot dS, or minus the integral. So the potential between the plates is going to be minus the integral of E dot dS. Or in this case, that's just E, the magnitude of E times the distance between the plates, which I didn't tell you, but I'll call it D here. So the potential between the plates, without worrying too much about the sign of things to get it confusing, the magnitude of the potential between the plates is going to go as sigma over epsilon naught, which is the magnitude of the field, times the distance. If we let the potential difference between the plates to be 1 volt, then the kinetic energy that the electron gains is said to be 1 electron volt. Or 1 EV. If that's the potential is work per unit charge. So the energy is equal to the charge times the potential. So now if the potential is 1 volt, then the kinetic energy is 1 electron volt. So that would be the charge of the electron times the 1 volt. So the kinetic energy of the electron is the amount of work, or the energy it gains going from a plate of 1 volt to another. This is, so 1 electron volt is going to be equal to 1 times the charge of the electron times 1 volt. So that's going to be equal to 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. coulombs times 1 volt. So 1 electron volt is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. Times electron volt, coulombs times a volt of joules. Sorry, this is joules. All right, so this may sound sort of silly. We just invented a unit of measure. This turns out to be extremely useful because if you want to create a beam of electrons, this is how you do it. You basically take two plates, you drill a little hole in one, and you charge these mamas up. And then eventually the electrons coming will sort of start streaming, right? And as they do, or what you would do is take a filament and charge it up negatively and heat it up so that the electrons actually will sort of jump off. You apply a big electric field right there, basically between two plates, and they'll go from one plate to the other. You drill a little hole, the beam will just basically come right out like that. And so how energetic is the beam? Well, it depends on how much potential you put across these things. So if you want a 1 EV beam, you would put 1 electron volt. If you want a 10 KEV beam, you'd put 10,000 volts across it, right? So that's how you do it. So it's a very convenient measure for all sorts of particle physics types applications and atomic physics and things like that. It's also something you'll see quite a bit. It's not part of this class, but some dude a while back named Einstein came up with this formula that E is equal to mc squared that some of you may have seen. So that's an energy mass equivalence. And what that means is if you were to put energy in terms of electron volts, then electron volts per c squared is a unit of mass. Okay? And so you'll often see the mass of particles, if they're appropriately done in the right units, MeV over c squared or something like that. Or if people are being a little bit careless, they'll just say, you know, it's so many MeV. So they're actually giving you an energy unit for the mass of the particle. But you're supposed to just know that, and if you're doing a problem, you have to know when and when not to put in the c squared. So just remember, electron volt is a unit of energy, not a unit of mass, but people will say it anyway. Another little thing to remember, get out your little decoder ring. I tend to write coulombs unit in terms of C-O-U-L because I'm not... Well, because coulomb is actually in the unit C, and C is in the symbol C, and yet these are not the same. And you're just supposed to know when it's one and when it's the other. So unit analysis is very important. Start with that. Any questions? There will come a time you'll be sitting in a class and the professor will start using units of E and C equal to 1. And that simplifies a lot of equations. I kid you not. It totally makes things, basically, you get to the end, and then you have to sort of insert the C's where they're really needed if you actually have to calculate something. But you will find that theoretical physicists, when you reach a certain point in your classes, you'll begin to use weird units where basically the C is just taken to be 1, so you don't have to use it all the time. All right. So let's imagine that, we're falling asleep. Let's imagine that we are not asleep, and let's do this. All right. So we know that the electric field between two charged plates is constant and uniform. What does the potential function look like between the two plates? So you have a number of different curves. Decide which one you think it is, because I'm not going to take the time right now to try to boot this thing up. We've had so much success with it so far. Okay, close your eyes. If you think it was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. All right, open your eyes. We had a handful of hands go up for 2, 3, 4, and 5. Almost even distribution. Okay. Why don't you chat about it for a moment with your neighbors? So let's see what we have. Close your eyes again. Number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. All right, so 5 and 6 were getting most of the votes. Had a handful for 2. All right, so let's see. We have the electric field is minus the gradient of the potential. All right. So we have a positive and constant electric field. So that means that minus the gradient of the potential has to be positive and constant. All right. So that means the gradient of the potential has to be negative and constant, but non-zero. So we have to have a slope. It has to be negative. And unless we have defined the zero of potential to be right here, I think it's probably ill-defined enough that I would take either 5 or 6 as the right answer. Okay? All right. Let's try one more. So we have a conducting shell with a non-trivial thickness here, which has an inner radius R1, an outer radius R2. There is a charge deposited at the center of this shell. The interior piece here is empty, and I would like to know what is the potential difference between points A and B. Thank you.
shown at the zero vector?
Yeah, the only charge in the problem is the one at the center here. All right, close your eyes. All who think it's number one, number two, number three, number four. All right, so we had probably most hands going up at one, and we had a good number of hands going up for two. So let's see. I'm asking for the potential difference between points A and B. This is a conductor, so the electric field inside that is by definition zero. So I can move charge from A to B freely with no work at all. Therefore, the potential difference between points A and B is zero. If I were to ask what is the potential of points A and B, then it would be KQ over R1, assuming that I've defined zero as the potential out at infinity, basically, right? If this isn't a conductor, then number two is correct. All right, but being a conductor, so you got to watch out for those little gotchas. Let's imagine that we have a charge, little charge plus Q over here, and some charge minus Q actually very far away. And let us suppose we ask, what is the potential near the plus charge? And the negative charge is really pretty far away. Then we could argue that the potential is more or less dominated by the plus charge nearby. So if I were to ask what is the potential, say, right here, the potential, I'll call V plus, is equal to KQ over R, where R is the distance from the positive charge. And just note that this V plus is proportional to the charge. Okay? Similarly, if we ask the same thing and we're down by the negative charge, V minus goes as minus KQ over R. And again, the potential outside of that is proportional to the charge that we have. Right? Now, if we want to know what is the potential difference between these two charges, actually, let me refine this a little bit because I didn't set it up carefully. We have two spheres, each with radius R, one with plus Q, one with minus Q, and we say they're far apart. We'll say that the potential difference between these two, which I'll call V plus minus, is equal to the potential of the plus minus the potential of the minus, which is equal to 2KQ over R. And that potential difference is also proportional to the charge between them. Okay? So what we find is if you look at different systems and you look at their potential or the differences in potential, you'll find that it's actually always proportional to the charge that's in the problem. So it may be different depending on the geometry that you're considering, but it I hope is becoming plausible that we could define a constant of proportionality for any of these particular situations. And that constant of proportionality is what we call the capacitance. And it will depend on the geometry. All right. So in this case, we would say that the charge plus is equal to C plus V plus. Charge on the minus sphere is equal to C minus V minus, and the potential difference, the charge, is equal to C plus minus V plus minus in this particular problem. Okay. So I think capacitance is one of these things that turns out to be very useful, but when you sort of see where it initially comes from, it doesn't make much sense. So it is this constant of proportionality. How is it that we really use it? What does it really mean? You'll find it coming in a lot of different places. The general relationship is that Q is equal to C times V. So that's the thing to remember. And then you can sort of go by what this tells you if you want to think about what it does. Capacitance quantifies how much charge is a system can hold. Had a given potential difference. Or you can invert that and you can say, it tells you if you throw so much charge on the system, what is the potential difference? So if you can have a plates like this and charge these up to a potential difference, and they'll hold a certain amount of charge. You can take these same plates and change the geometry so that it looks like this, for example, and put plus V and minus V here. And actually, it will hold a different amount of charge because you've changed the geometry. So the capacitance in these two geometries is actually going to be different, even though you might have kept a lot of things the same. All right. Physicists like C. I want you to remember that C is used for calorie. C is used for heat capacity. C is used for Coulomb. C is used for speed of light. C is also used for capacitance. And the units of C are farads for Michael Faraday. You need to someday, when you are well along in your physics training and you are one of the gods of physics wherever you are, go back and look at this slide. And you will at that time be able to distinguish the fine differences between all of these C's. And you'll know how to do it. Look, all I'm going to say is don't blame me, okay? I'm just the messenger. This is how we do it, and you just have to tell by context. So we use the unit of C for capacitance. We use the symbol C for capacitance. And So capacitors are certainly they are something you'll often see in circuits, and we've talked about the EMF or the battery as basically being a source of potential difference. Generally, in the symbol of the EMF, the longer line is where you have positive potential, and the negative, the shorter one, you have negative. You can think of the longer one as being the source of the positive charge and the shorter one as the source of the negative charge. And if you hook these up to a capacitor or a nice capacitor, for example, would be one that just looks like a parallel plate, because we understand that geometry very nicely. Then that positive charge will come over here to that plate, and you will have, if you charge this parallel plate system or this capacitor up to a certain potential difference, it will hold a certain amount of charge in here. It will store charge. So these devices, which we call capacitors in circuits, act as a reservoir of charge. And just remember that this EMF, or the electromotive force, what it really does is it maintains a constant potential difference between its terminals. Okay? So what I'd like to do is to spend a moment actually analyzing this geometry a little bit, because we now know a bit about parallel plates. So let's see what we can learn from looking at that geometry. I want to blow it up. Let me think for a second whether I need to go through something or I can do it easier. All right, I guess I will do it this way. Okay, so let's imagine that we have a parallel plate, and we'll just sort of say it has a non-trivial thickness. Have you gotten that word, non-trivial? You got to start using it. It really pisses everybody else off, because it makes you sound like such a jerk. If you're amongst physicists, it's fine. Use it all the time. Everybody sort of knows what it means. Oh, well, that's non-trivial. Meaning, oh, I wouldn't have thought of that, or something like that. But if you use that amongst your friends or family, you sound like such a jerk. Just keep that in mind, because if you're not already doing that, you're going to get so used to saying it, it's just going to come out, and you're going to get these looks like, wow. What a loser. Okay, so we're going to have a parallel plate with a non-trivial thickness. We can define it that way. That would be good. Look at this. What year are you? Freshman, sophomore? And already contributing to the wonders of physics. This is great. Wow, a sophomore, and he's already invented his own thing to call C. That's good. I know some students who get all the way to their PhD defense before we can manage to make them do that. So what I'd like to do is to take a Gaussian surface that looks sort of like this. So it comes right along the edges and goes inside the space. And it's, okay, this is going to be a tiny bit of hand waving. I'm basically putting this thing right near the edge, and we're going to assume the edge effects are basically zero. Now, they wouldn't be in real life. If you actually went to the edge of a parallel plate, the field is clearly going to be coming out a bit like this, but we're going to ignore that for now. So we're going to sort of assume the electric field is straight across everywhere, and I choose this sort of Gaussian box where this bottom piece has exactly the same area as the parallel plate. And this top piece is inside the metal of the plate, so the field is zero. So what that means is the contribution to Gauss's law, the left-hand side, for this piece on the side, this piece on the top, and this piece over here, is all zero. And so what we have is that the electric field going straight through times the area here, E times A, is going to be the left-hand side of Gauss's law for this Gaussian surface. So a touch of hand waving. And we're going to say that the integral of E dot dA is equal to E times A in this case. And the distance between these two we'll call D, or we could call it C if we wanted. And what I'd like to do is to find an expression for the capacitance. Just also, each plate has charge Q. And area A. And sigma is equal to Q over A for each of the plates. All right. So if we take Gauss's law, for our surface, then on the left-hand side, as we saw, we have E times A, and on the right-hand side, we have Q enclosed. Well, that's the total charge on the surface of the plate here, which is this Q, but that's also sigma times A. So this is going to be sigma times A over epsilon naught. The potential difference, I think we did earlier. It's just E times D. That magnitude of the potential difference is just this E times D. So we've seen that before. V between the plates is equal to E times D. So the capacitance we define as the charge divided by the potential between the plates. The charge is equal to sigma times A, and the potential difference is E times D. And E here is just sigma over E. Or epsilon naught, I mean. So this is going to be epsilon naught A over D. So the capacitance for this parallel plate system goes as epsilon naught times the area of the parallel plates divided by the distance between them. And as I promised earlier, this is nothing but geometry. Okay? But if we vary the area, vary the distance, then we're going to change the capacitance. Any questions? All right. We're going to do lots of things with capacitors, but among them we will be looking at capacitors and circuits. So we are not limited to putting one capacitor in a circuit. We could have many. So we need to look at capacitors, multiple capacitors in a circuit. So let us imagine that you can arrange them one of two ways. You can either have them in parallel in the circuit, or you can have them, I'm sorry, that's in series. Or you can have them in parallel. Okay, and so we need to look at how to handle multiple ones in each circuit. So let's first look at parallel. So let us imagine that we have some C in, some C2, a C1. So these all have different capacitances, but they're in the same circuit. And I'm going to put a potential difference across here of V. So I hook it across a battery. And here we'll call this as the parallel situation. So if I have any of these capacitors with a potential difference across them, I know that I have a certain charge. So that means that I will have here, across this one, I will have Q1 is equal to C1 times V. Across this one, I'll have Q2 is equal to C2 times V. Across this one, I'll have CQN is equal to CN times V. The total charge that I have, Q tot, would be, if you imagine that I put a big box around this and I called it a single capacitor, and I don't even know that it has this other stuff inside, then I can put this single capacitor across this potential and I can see how much charge I've got, and that's what I'm going to call Q tot. So Q tot is going to be equal to the sum of all of the charges that are spread across each of these conductors. So Q tot is going to be equal to Q1 plus Q2 plus Q3 onto Q sub n. But Q tot is also CV, so so C total times V is equal to C1 times V plus C2 times V plus C sub n times V. And now I just remove the V, and I get that the total capacitance is equal to the sum of the I capacitors in the system. So you'll have to use this. The sum for capacitors in parallel, the total capacitance is the sum of the capacitances. Okay? Yes?
How do we know the V right after the total capacitance is equal to the V of the all the individual capacitances?
Because this is all a conductor. So the field in that is zero, and it takes no charge to, no work to move charge in there. All right, so I guess this is for capacitors in parallel. So next what I'd like to do is to take a circuit where I have N capacitors, but now they're in series. And again, I'll put this across a potential V, or put a potential V across it, okay? And again, like we did earlier, we can imagine having this box around it and ask what is the C tot for that box of that includes all the capacitors. So if I have this box around whatever it is, I put a potential across it, I know it has some charge, so I know that Q tote is equal to C tote times V. And now I want you to think a little bit about how this works. The C tote basically has to be the charge on this side of the capacitor and that side of the capacitor, because I don't really know what's inside that capacitor. But so if I put a C tote here, I'm sorry, a Q tote here, what happens here? This is a conductor. It's not actually hooked to anything, but I will get an electric field here, so I will induce a charge here, which, because I have an conductor here, the field has to be zero here. So the only way to do that is to induce a charge here, which is equal and opposite in charge from what you have on the other plate. That, of course, will leave a charge on this plate, which is equal and opposite of that which we just induced, which will induce da-da-da-da-da. So what we end up with is Q tote positive right here, Q tote negative here, positive, negative, positive, negative, positive, negative, positive. So you end up inducing the same charge across each of these particular capacitors. So you end up with plus Q tote across this plate, and then in here you have minus Q tote, and in here you've induced a minus Q tote and a plus Q tote, a minus Q tote and a plus Q tote. Okay? Now what I'd like to do is to look at this potential difference. Remember, a potential difference is the work per unit charge it takes to move a charge across. So this potential difference has to be equal to the potential difference across each of these summed together, because I could move the charge like this, or I could move it straight through here, and I have to end up with the same potential difference across the two. So the total potential V is equal to V1 plus V2 up to V sub n, and V is equal to Q is equal to CV, so V is equal to Q over C. So we have, this is equal to Q tote over C tote, which is the charge across capacitor 1, which is also Q tote because that's what's been induced, over C1 plus Q tote over C2 plus all the way up to Q tote over C sub n. So now Q tote divides out, and I end up with 1 over C tote is equal to 1 over C1 plus 1 over C2 plus 1 over C sub n, or 1 over C tote is equal to the sum of 1 over C sub I. And that is that the reciprocal of the total capacitance is the sum of the reciprocals of the capacitances for capacitors in series. Any questions? All right. I think we've got a... Well, let's see. What are we? We go from 11:05 to 12:20. Okay. They can wait. I sort of hear the hordes at the door. However, having said that, it's a good place to stop. I don't want to start the next thing. So, okay? See you next time.